Agency of Madness!
Bonjour and bienvenue to the Battle Royale Regency of Madness, where nice. We're talking about the regents of Charles VI.
He'll be chosen as the supreme regent, and who will fall victim to the madness? Sorry, Addison.
Je m'appelle Ben Clark.
And I'm Eliza Summers.
And we have with us a very special guest yet again. This time it's Veronica Fortune from the past podcast. Hello, Veronica.
Hello. Bonjour. How are you doing?
Very good. It's very good to have you. Today you will be talking to us about Louis of Bourbon.
Yes.
Louis II of Bourbon, I should say.
Yes.
Who is one of the uncles.
Yes, he's different than all the other uncles.
Different to all the other uncles of Charles VI. And I will be doing the other remaining uncle, the leftover uncle, if you will. John Duke of Berry.
Poor Barry. I actually had a lot of trouble picking which uncle I wanted to do, and he actually would have been my second choice, so...
Yeah, okay. Barry is... I have a soft spot for Barry, which we'll get into.
Yes.
I've always been drawn to him.
Oh, he sounds amazing in so many ways. Just in very different ways.
Every time you say Barry, I just think of the fruit. And I'm like, do they eat berries? Like, I know it's spelled differently, but you know.
No, it's spelled exactly the same.
Oh, it is?
Yep.
It's spelled differently.
E-R-R-Y. Although in French, they put emphasis on the last syllable, so it would be Barry.
Yes.
But I'm going to say Barry because it's easier for me to say.
And I'm going to say bourbon instead of Bourbon.
If you say bourbon, I will not judge you.
Okay. Well, I'll be saying bourbon.
I'm saying Barry wrong. You could say bourbon wrong. It's fine.
I've been using way too much French recently, so I'm just going to stick with English pronunciations today.
I think Bourbon is a bit laborious.
I do enjoy saying it, though. Bourbon. Yeah. You could do a bad accent, too.
So we're going to call them Barry and bourbon. Barry and bourbon. Just for clarity.
I wonder how that would be a good drink together.
One of them's called John, one of them's called Louis, and like those are names that we've had too much. So we're just going to call them Barry and Bourbon.
When you guys visit Sydney next, we can go have some Barry and Bourbon. How's that
exactly sound?
I'm actually going to be there next week.
Oh, well, my goodness.
We could go to Barry, New South Wales, and drink some bourbon there.
Oh, I like the way you think. I knew we'd get along.
It's a gorgeous little town. But anyway, so... There are a lot fewer moving parts in this episode than our last one when Josh came to discuss Philip of Burgundy, we have so much more written about, and he did so many more things, and there was a lot going on last episode, basically. Yep. So we've already covered, basically, Veronica, just for your context, we've covered up until the assassination of Louis of Orléans.
Oh, wow.
That whole ground from like the start of Charles's reign, actually even before Charles's reign, up to the assassination, like we covered all that last episode. So in this episode we'll be like reminding you guys about stuff that happened, but we won't be going too much into detail about again.
We did that.
Because that would get repetitive. So the rivalry between Orléans and Burgundy will be kind of the background noise of this episode while we talk about the far more chillaxed existences of the less dramatic regions.
I think these two actually even liked each other. Like everything could find is that they worked really well together, and so this will be a much more congenial episode than your last one. And your next one.
The rest of the pairings for the Regency of Madness I chose because they had a kind of adversarial kind of relationship. But for this one, I just thought...
They're chums.
They're more sort of parallel than contrasting, I guess.
Yes.
But
so different. So different.
So different and so similar. So, especially with their names. So Veronica, Louis of Bourbon is born first, would you like to launch us into his life?
I will. So All right, here we go. So Louis II, Duke of Bourbon, he has some good nicknames, as in Le Bon, or the Good. And he was born the 4th of February, 1337. And he is related to Charles VI through his sister, Joanna, or Jeanne, and through Charles of Valois, Charles VI's great-grandfather, and Louis's grandfather. As my line of my show goes, everyone's related.
So the Bourbons are like one of those branches of the Capetians that kind of broke off around the same time that Valois did, basically.
And it gets even messier.
So should I just shame they're like the Targaryens then? To a degree?
Yeah.
Just short of brother-sister marriage. Yes.
Yeah. I get to a point in my current season where it starts looking Habsburgian. With the children of Francis I, because three of his he and his wife, their children, three of their eight great-grandparents were the same people. Ooh. Or siblings, sorry.
It's,
yeah.
It's pretty insane. And it's not even like the top royals either. Like, I'm researching the Armagnac family right now. It's it's a twisted web.
It's a bush. It's not a tree.
Yeah.
It's like a wreath made from a tree. So the mental illness that you will eventually get to, we will eventually get to with Charles VI, actually comes from the Bourbon family. It's can be traced all the way back to Louis I of Bourbon. So Louis's great-grandfather and Charles VI's great-great-grandfather. And Bourbon, his sister Joanna, they both appeared to have suffered from this somewhat. And though it looks as though Joanna's was worse, they both took the form of nervous breakdowns for the two of them, which is, I think, quite sad. I'm quite sympathetic to this part of this family's history. Yeah,
same.
The mental illness is really unfair.
I mean, it would help if they stopped marrying their cousin. But anyway.
I agree with you 100%.
But it's not like that was the choice of the children.
No, this is why I'm married to someone who cannot be related to me in any way, shape, or form. Like, it's impossible.
So John of Berry, I just realized I didn't write down his birthday, which is...
Oh, I have him up. Just a second.
Which is a...
Would be helpful.
Oh, no, I don't. Sorry, I had it up earlier.
Okay. I've got it down here as the 4th of February, 1337 for Bourbon.
The 3rd of November, 1430 for Barry.
Barry's born like 3 years later. And Barry, by contrast, has the same parents as Philip, Duke of Burgundy, and King Charles V. He's the son of John II of France and Bonne of Bohemia. And we've talked to death about them. So Barry, by contrast to Bourbon, seems to have been the most sort of stable mentally member of the family.
I think he was the most stable of all of them.
He hadn't inherited any of the madness. He didn't have overweening desire for power, which is what his other brothers had. I think of his personality as more like his eldest brother, Charles V, who we really like.
Who
at this point in the story is still the Dauphin. So he's sort of more placid and gentle, but he's still very intelligent in like a sort of bookwormy kind of way.
Charles V is my favorite French king. Honestly, I absolutely love him.
I don't know if he's my favorite, but he's very underrated, as we found in this episode. And we did spare him from the guillotine. So good.
I haven't gotten there yet.
For me, it'll always be the 6th, just because I have my own family history of mental health, so I got a soft spot for somebody with mental health issues.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Does that mean that Henry the 6th is your favorite English king?
Oh.
No, that's different.
Or I don't have a favorite English king.
England has a few of them,
Because they didn't have they didn't have the interesting fragile glass syndrome.
Well, apparently Henry the 6th had the same thing inherited from Charles the 6th.
Charles the 6th.
Oh.
But anyway, we'll get to that.
Genetics is fun.
Yeah. So in 1356, so when he's about 16, Barry was made Count of Poitiers. But I'll keep referring to him as Barry because he eventually gets the Duchy of Barry. Because I'm not calling him John. I'm not doing it.
Too many Johns.
And he also eventually ruled Auvergne and Montpensier, which gave him a big chunk of central France.
Nice.
And the title of Duke was given to Berry 4 years, 4 years after he was made Count of Poitiers, around the time of his 20th birthday, and his marriage to Joan of Armagnac. We haven't really talked about it yet, but making royal sons dukes rather than just counts is a new development of the Valois, who were determined to sort of increase the royal prestige. So before it's you make the sons counts, and now it's dukes. Yeah. It's a different level.
Yeah.
I think it's overcompensating a little for the monarchy's weakening in power, but that's just my opinion.
I like this opinion. I approve of it.
Yeah.
I do prefer the word duke to count, though. So.
Yeah. Well, Edward III did something similar in England, so it's not surprising the Valois were like, we all need to match this and up it.
Yeah. So the choice of bride for Berry, Joan of Armagnac, is related to his role, which was to be a sort of lieutenant governor for the king in the south of France. The Armagnacs are a noble Gascon family. Mm-hmm. So they're way down in the southwest of France, in that territory that like England used to own, but France has very recently taken over. So they're trying to make friends with that family and try to get more of a grasp over the south. And the Armagnacs at this point are very anti-English, pro-French, and quite aggressive about it as well.
They like switching sides occasionally.
They do like switching sides occasionally, but generally they're against the Burgundians, which we'll get to in particular.
Who can blame them?
Who can blame them? This is very refreshing from Josh last episode, who was like, oh, the Burgundians are great.
He loves them so much. He's going to be devastated when I cover them.
Yeah. Yeah. So meanwhile, back to Bourbon.
So Bourbon became the Duke of Bourbon and the Grand Chamberlain of France after his father died at Poitiers. Yeah. Fancy. Yeah. The Grand Chamberlain of France thing is semi-hereditary. The king needs to confirm it at each time, but it should go to a Bourbon. And when it doesn't in the future, well after this Bourbon's life, it's pretty bad. So his father died at Poitiers, along with a lot of other people. And John II and Philip the Bold were, of course, taken hostage. And as part of the Treaty of Brittany, the treaty that got John kind of back to France for a while, Bourbon was sent as a hostage in 1360. So he got to go hang out in England for a while.
And meanwhile, Berry was also sent as a hostage.
Yes.
As well. So Berry had almost been at Poitiers as well. He was the Count of Poitiers after all.
He was nearby, wasn't he?
He was nearby, but he was supposed to have been at the battle, but King John sent him away when things were looking a bit dicey. So both he and Philip were actually sent away, as we talked about last episode. But Berry's little brother Philip came back and fought alongside his father till the bitter end, getting captured. But even though he managed to avoid the battle, Berry, as well as his other brother Anjou, ended up becoming prisoners in London anyway. So it's Berry, Anjou, and Bourbon all being sent to London.
Can you imagine? He's like, I wasn't even there. God, why do I have to go?
Yeah.
Why does Philip get to come home and I have to go away?
It's
bull.
I think it's mostly because Philip was John II's favorite son.
By far.
He wanted him to stay with him. But yeah, as I said, as we mentioned, Anjou, he quickly walks out the door and goes back to...
Literally, like, one of my favorite moments in history.
But Berry and Bourbon, they were good boys. They remained captives, enjoying the hospitality of the English. Berry even sired an illegitimate son on a servant belonging to a visiting Scottish delegation.
Wow.
So he found a wee lassie to have some fun with.
Oh my god.
Wee lassie.
And by the way, this is very shortly after his marriage to Joan of Armagnac.
Well,
he's lonely. And Berry, he's lonely. So Barry, he showed an early appreciation for the finer things in life, and he grew mm-hmm. to be jolly and fat, but surprisingly healthy, as he will, spoiler alert, outlive both Bourbon and all of his brothers.
Huh? Yep.
Healthy man.
Yes. Really healthy. So, I've realized I didn't put when Louis, or when Bourbon got married, but don't mm-hmm. worry, it's not for a while. So, okay.
Late bloomer. So,
for, yeah, a bit.
Gets married at a reasonable actually, really, age.
Really a bit of a late bloomer. So, while I was gone, things in Bourbon, like the place, went really badly. His mother, whose name was Isabella of Valois, like the most common Valois woman, female name ever. Was in charge, and she had to deal with the companies, which I'm sure you've talked about at this point. So those roving bands of mercenaries and former soldiers who were fighting on either side of the Hundred Years' War. So they were just basically terrorizing Bourbon lands. Yeah. And they his lords actually even helped with their robberies. It wasn't a good situation. And he was finally released in 1366, so after 6 years, and he was 30 at that point. And it was actually 3 years into his brother-in-law Charles V's reign. And on his return, he founded the Order of the Shield in 1366 or 69. Yeah, chivalric orders were so hot now.
Yeah, there was the Order of the Star, which I think John II founded.
Yes.
And then Charles V kind of ran into the ground. Because he didn't really care about it.
No. Can you blame Charles V? He's like, I am now, over war and all of this chivalry. Even though
now I'm thinking, what would I call my order if I had one?
Yeah, the gold shield, I'm not, like, it's not a great
actually, it'd probably order. Be Order of the Sloth.
Oh, it has such a cute little badge. Oh.
I know it would.
I can't wait to tell you guys about Charles of... Orléans order. Well, his father's order that became his. It's cool.
Nice.
Yeah.
So we'll have to under have you Charles... back sometime.
I know. Oh, that could be so exciting. Spoilers. Sorry, guys. Under Charles V's kingship, he, of course, led some armies in Poitou and Guyenne. And he took Limoges back from the English in August of 1370 with the help of Barry, which I think is awesome teamwork.
Yeah. High five.
Yeah, high five. He assisted in the protection of Paris against John of Gaunt, one of my favorite human beings ever. And less than a month later, he actually almost captured John of Gaunt, which I think was probably the scariest moment of John of Gaunt's entire life. And in what I think is the best thing he ever did is he fought against Charles the Bad, the King of Navarre, in the late 1370s. Ooh. Yeah, and I don't know if you guys have discussed Charles the Bad yet, but...
Oh, yes, we discussed him plenty in John II's episode.
Yes, sorry, I haven't gotten there yet, but...
No, but John II was like a 2-hour episode, mostly because of Charles the Bad.
I'm not surprised. I think my special episode of him for my patrons was 2 hours long. He is shocking in every way. So I really high five.
Charles the Bad seems like so long ago for us. It's weird to think of these lifetimes overlapping.
Yes. Bourbon did live a long time, so it's not surprising that he would have that experience. But I just love that anyone that was fighting against Charles the Bad, I'm all for it. He deserved that super K.
It's a rite of passage.
It is. So what else did Barry do to help Louis, to help Bourbon, obviously?
So Barry, he got back from London shortly after Bourbon, and he came back sort of promising a ransom to the English, which may not have ever been sent. Instead,
still waiting Barry, for it to this day.
Barry just got as far away from England as possible. He yeeted himself way down to the French Riviera, as you do. Because his brother, Charles V, he needed a governor for the Languedoc, which, if we remember, is that that pesky region in the far south of France, which is like very rich, like on the border of Spain. It's where like Carcassonne is. It's like just south of Toulouse.
Sounds like a nice
place. Where all the Cathar rebels are. But it's very, you know, lucrative. And at this point, it's part of the royal domain. So Barry needs to go down and like, you know, govern it. But unfortunately, Barry's reign there is blighted by a number of, you know, pesky peasant revolts, resulting in the Duke extorting huge fines out of the southerners to help finance his increasingly extravagant lifestyle, which we will get to.
That's pretty harsh.
It's a minus. And then in 1380, Charles V dies, and Charles VI, little Charles VI, needs some regents.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He does. So at that point, Bourbon became one of his regents. And of course, Charles VI was only 11, so we can't let him properly king. And Bourbon happened to be his favorite uncle. And my guess and everything I can find is it's likely due to the fact that Bourbon had next to no chance of ever becoming king, wasn't vying for the throne in any way, shape, or form, and really just
he was the kind fun of uncle.
Yeah, he also wanted to protect his nephew's interests because at the end of the day, if he helps his nephew, he's going to prosper from it instead of just trying to overtake his nephew. And he lent Bourbon military aid to the royal family, to the royal military, and he was provided with funding, which I'm sure we'll get into, is just something that all of Charles' regents had. It was just everyone's hand was in the royal piggy bank.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So the general timeline is, so 1380 to 1382, the uncles were all kind of junior regents to the eldest uncle, Anjou. And then from 1382 to 1388, when Anjou f***ed off to Naples and later died, Barry and Bourbon officially became co-regents alongside Burgundy. So the three B's, Barry, Bourbon, Burgundy. but during this period, Barry became more active as a military presence in northern France. He hasn't had any battles so far, really. But he's a bit late to the game. So he was present at the Battle of Rustebeck, where Philip of Burgundy sort of solidified his own reputation as this great like military leader. But after a subsequent failure to subdue more revolts, mainly in Flanders, and a failed attempt to counter-invade England, the uncle regents were all sent packing in 1388 when the Marmosets rose to power.
Yay.
So Josh went to all of this in plenty of detail last episode, so go back and listen to that if you want more.
I can imagine I gave him some sources on it.
But that's my very hackneyed layman's summary of that. So to make matters particularly bad for Barry with the rise of the Marmosets decided to do a royal inquiry into his governance of the Languedoc.
Oh, no.
Which included a personal visit from the king himself in 1390. So Barry's in trouble. Yeah, so young Charles VI.
Oh my god, I just imagine him being like, surprise! And Barry's like, oh my god, what are you doing here? Dropping the glass of wine.
Charles VI at this point is like in his 20s. He's basically the most capable that he's ever going to be. He's like this strapping young man. He hasn't had a psychotic breakdown. Like this is the peak. And he was horrified at the corruption that he found down south.
Yeah, you'd hope so.
Yeah, I was going to say, I think that all of the individuals that suffered from this particular familial mental illness prior to their initial first breakdown were often at the best point. And so that makes it even more heartbreaking, especially in Charles VI's case. Like, had he not had this mental illness, he actually could have been a really good king based on his early performance. Yeah. So it's just, I don't think Henry VI Yeah, I don't think Henry VI would have been a great king based on his initial performance, regardless of the mental breakdown. Sorry.
Oh, yeah. Again, we'll get to that. So Charles VI, he was horrified at the corruption he found in the Languedoc. Barry was suspended as governor. And his chief financial minister, Jean Bertezac, was actually burned at the stake for corruption and mismanagement.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah. Because, you know, you can't punish the prince. You have to punish his underling, like, sort of as a scapegoat on behalf of him. But Barry would regain the governorship in 1401, over 10 years later. But he held it pretty much in name only because he didn't really make it down to the south of France much because of certain chaotic things that were happening in the north that he needed to keep an eye on.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. Things go a bit tits up from this point on.
Yeah. I'll quickly share when Bourbon got married. So in 1371, he married the Countess of Forez, Anne of, oh man, you guys, my French pronunciation. I think it's Auvergne, but I'm probably wrong. And she was only 13 at the time.
How old was he?
Is it A-U-V-E-R?
R-G-N-E, yeah.
Yeah, Auvergne.
Auvergne. Auvergne, and she was only 13 at the time, so he would have been, 34 or 35, yeah. So one of those normal for the time marriages that should make all of our skin crawl today, right?
Yeah, but then, what's that age gap, like 20-something?
Yeah.
Do you know why it took so long to get Bourbon married?
I would assume part of it was because he wasn't married before he went to England. So that's 6 years kind of took away from it. Yeah. The other problem is, so like sources for him, what I had to do, so I'm an outside subscriber to the ANU library. So I basically went to their 100 Years War section and I grabbed down every one of his cousins and family members and books that were around his time period. And I literally just turned to the index in the back and found his name and then went and read about him on there and just added notes in there. And that's what you have to do a lot of times for these, I'm going to put quotes around this, lesser figures.
And that's what I did for Barry.
Yeah. It's like, great. I'm now reading someone else's biography and there he is. And I've done it before in earlier episodes for different people and it works, but you miss out on a lot of those types of details, which is quite sad, I think. Yeah. They often, would have four.
Very
kids,
often happens for the women rulers that I've done.
Oh my gosh, it's painfully bad.
Scouring indexes. Yeah.
I'm like, please let something in this book about affairs in writing in the 1300s tell me a tiny bit, a tiny bit about Joan II of Navarre. Just please.
Yeah.
So Bourbon had four children with her. The only one you need to worry about is John of Bourbon, his oldest son. So, don't worry. Yeah. His other stuff will come up in his scandalous section. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. All right. Oh, yes. But
back to the 1390s.
Back to the 1380s. Yeah. 1380s. So he wasn't helping run France anymore because obviously his nephew was in charge. And so he decided to go on crusade. I know. What year is it? What year?
What number crusade is this?
It's so 2 centuries ago.
It really is. So the ones in the Holy Land had been out of style for about 100 years at this point. So this is a Barbary crusade. And the goal is to besiege the stronghold of the Barbary pirates in modern day Tunisia. So a crusade at this point was basically used to label a military action as a holy action. So if you died in it, you wouldn't go hang out in purgatory for very long. It'd give you that straight shot into heaven. Nice. Yeah. The crusaders lost, in case you're curious. It's not surprising at all at this point. Their record had... The record had really gone downhill since, you know.
Was there ever a good record?
I will argue in favor of Robert Curthose and his performance in that first crusade, but other than that, no. No, not really.
You know, Eliza, you keep saying, were any of the crusades successful? Yes, the first one was successful. They should have.
Well, okay, it would not have been been okay. It would not have been successful if they had to then do a second one. Okay, no, that's but the my
second
argument.
No. The second one failed so badly that it yeah. destroyed the success of the first one.
And there were crusades. I think the reconquest of Spain is considered a crusade, and then the Cathars, yes,
that would be
Cathars in southern France were considered a crusade, and that one was sadly successful as well.
Yeah, and the Northern Crusades, which destroyed the Lithuanians, the last pagans in Europe.
Yes.
That was also sadly successful.
So where's the fun ones that are successful? I mean, against the fun ones.
I mean, the Lithuanians were fine. Their royal family ended up becoming the Polish royal family, so that's good for them. Yeah. So meanwhile, Barry, back in France, is being a bit more fashionable. He's not going on crusade. And he shows off his fashion when he comes back north and increases his own presence in Paris, builds a bit of influence.
Does he wear something in particular?
Well, he builds himself a number of gorgeous, very fashionable residences.
Oh.
But yeah, probably also wore
some interesting thing.
He probably also wore extravagant furs and everything. There's actually, well, we'll get into it in Enchanté, but there's an excellent portrait of him with a very amazing fur hat.
Oh, so beautiful!
It's so beautiful. He's a babe. and he built himself. Yeah, so he built himself. A number of gorgeous residences. The one he frequented most was the Hotel Danel on the outskirts of the capital.
Do any of them exist today?
I think some of them, not the ones in Paris.
No. Bourges? Did I say that right? Bourges still exists.
Bourges.
Yes, thank you.
Which is the capital of Berry. Yes, that exists.
And it's beautiful. The pictures I've seen, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a classic sort of 14th century, like Sleeping Beauty kind of castle.
Oh, nice.
But yeah, the Hotel Danel in Paris is his main like Paris residence. And this is the place where the Tour Danel affair happened, Eliza.
Oh.
So I imagine Barry probably like loved regaling his visitors with like stories of like the adulterous shenanigans that happened in his palace.
The end of that is so horrible.
The end of it is horrible, but I just imagine like Barry purchasing this palace just because he's living for the drama.
Probably.
It does sound like him.
Yes.
So not long after his Bourbon's return from his crusades that he lost, Charles VI suffered his first mental health episode. Mm. So it was in 1392. And it did mean that he would need a further regency. So with Bourbon, when he would have his episodes, he would recover from them really successfully and be able to do things afterwards. Whereas you'll see throughout Charles VI's life, as he has more, things get worse for him. So he has quite a degradation in his mental health. And I do think that Bourbon would have been completely devastated that his nephew had this. It was something that the family was obviously aware of at this point. And they knew where it came from. Charles VI wasn't sick all the time. In a lot of my research, especially with other members of this family that I've looked at, most winters he was well. And this has been seen in modern hospitalizations for depression and bipolar disorder. So you see fewer hospitalizations in winter and more in autumn and spring, which I think is quite interesting that his symptoms matched up specifically with that. And what's further interesting is schizophrenia has a different hospitalization pattern to it. So it may discount some of the theories of what mental illness the family had.
Yeah. Mm. Although it could always be both.
It could. Sadly, mental illness is very complicated.
Could be like comorbid or something.
Yes.
So yeah, both Barry and Bourbon are back as regents. But once again, it was really the third and the youngest B, Burgundy, who really held the power, being like the richest, the most ambitious, and the most charismatic of them all.
Nice.
And this continued after Burgundy's death in 1404, when his son John the Fearless, for next episode, took over.
Oh, yes. So I don't want to ruin everything about John the Fearless for the next episode, but I'm going to have to ruin some of it. So Charles the Sixth brother, Louis of Orléans, tried to challenge John the Fearless's control of the council.
Yeah.
And John had him killed. And it's
it's
pretty disgusting, everything that happened. Louis, or Bourbon, obviously, as one of the regents, was a member of council.
Horrified?
Like, more than horrified. So he absolutely adored his nephews. He was obviously Charles the Sixth.
He sounds like such a good uncle.
I think he really was. He definitely gets the good uncle title. But he was Charles the Sixth's favorite uncle, and he really adored Louis of Orléans, who has all sorts of his own issues going on, but really did in general, I think, care about his brother. He was actually killed after having dinner with his sister-in-law, so Isabeau of Bavaria. And he had been told by one of Charles's servants that the king needed him. And because he cared for his brother so much, he just went straight there. And he and another member of his retinue were killed on the way.
This is a deep cut, but this reminds me of the last chapter in the last Game of Thrones book that is out
to date.
5 million years ago.
Where Jon Snow is told they found his brother or something, and he goes and then he gets stabbed.
Yep.
Spoiler alert for Game of Thrones.
Yes. it's actually very like that. It's his uncle, I think.
Jon Snow is canonically dead in the books. Just saying.
I had no idea. Because when was the last time a book came out?
It feels
he got resurrected in the show. It's fine.
anyway. So what's horrible about Jon doing this is he had planned this for weeks in advance. He had even
not Jon Snow, Jon the Fearless. Sorry,
yes, Jon the Fearless. Sorry,
we like the Fearless.
That's real life.
And he had even invited Louis of Orléans to dinner with him the Sunday after he knew the murder would be carried out.
Oh,
so it was in Louis's diary that he would be meeting his cousin. Like, it's horrible. So Jon was then
like
able
he's trying to set up an alibi.
Oh, it gets worse.
Yeah. The weird thing about it is that, like, it seems like he's, like, it seems like he, that would be a great opportunity for an alibi, and yet.
Oh, no, he was an idiot. I don't want to ruin everything. But he hid his crime for the first few days after the killing as well. And I won't ruin it for when you get to him. But when Bourbon found out, he swore never to look at John the Fearless again, and he stuck to it.
Ooh. Ooh! Oh my god, the same room and he just does not look at him. He's like,
he refused to come to court if he knew John the Fearless would be there. He really did not ever want to see John the Fearless again. And it's quite impressive he managed to do it.
Not that he had to do it for very much longer.
No, he didn't. he was 68 at this point. So he can't obviously do military work at 68. And what he did do was he focused on preparing his lands for his oldest son, John. And he did not want... John. Yeah, not your John, but John of Bourbon. and he wanted his great-nephew, Charles of Orléans, Louis of Orléans' son, to have justice regarding the murder of his father. Nice. So that sadly didn't go well because a civil war started in France. And Bourbon, of course, wasn't active in this because he was old. And sadly, he died on the 10th of August, 1410. And his son, John, would succeed him. And John got to hang out with Charles of Orléans for a while because they were both taken prisoner after the Battle of Agincourt.
Oh.
Which we will definitely get to.
Yeah.
but yeah, Veronica will be returning in... I guess the finale of the
I know. I'm really excited.
to talk about Charles of Orléans. So we'll get some continuity there.
Nice.
But for now, Bourbon is dead. So let's get back to Barry.
Yes. Sorry, Bourbon.
Barry lived for another 6 years. And they were in an eventful 6 years for him, despite Barry being even older. So Barry, did his best to maintain like a strong, stable, continuous presence in and around Paris, while John the Fearless, by contrast, was like flying all over the place, starting civil wars, And Charles of Orléans was demanding
trying vengeance. To put out the flames.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
So during this later period, Barry was mostly charged with overseeing the education of Charles VI's children. So mm-hmm. his great nieces and nephews, particularly the Dauphin.
Yeah. Oh, what a good uncle to have do that.
Exactly.
Genuinely a good choice.
Very good choice. We'll get into it, limited but Barry, choices. Barry's very educated. He has this massive library. Like he's such a good person to do this. And you know, he's hoarded a lot of wealth to hire good tutors. but Barry, but so at true. This point, we are so. Well, I think we mentioned it last episode, but basically, Charles VI didn't have great luck with. His sons surviving. So at this point we are at the last Dauphin who will eventually become King Charles VII. So this is the Dauphin that we have at this point, or shortly after this point. Either way, we're at the last Dauphin now. Having control over the royal children was very crucial at this point, because everyone thought, you know, Charles VI isn't long for this world. Spoiler, he'll hang on for another 10 years. but yeah, it meant you controlled the future of France if you controlled the heirs. And up to this point, Barry had been trying his best to sort of mediate the disputes between Burgundy and Orléans. But when John the Fearless took credit for the murder of Louis of Orléans, so basically he was like, I did it, deal with it. Barry completely gave up on the Burgundians, and he put his weight behind the Orléans faction.
Good.
Who are confusingly also called the Armagnacs by this point. This is because Count Bernard the 7th of Armagnac, Barry's great nephew and son-in-law, don't think about it too much.
Everyone's related.
Who I'm actually going to talk about next episode. I'm going to talk about Bernard of Armagnac. But he sort of came up north with this huge, unruly southern army of spicy Gascons. who fought alongside Orléans and, like, wreaked all kinds of havoc. They occupied Paris for a while, and Parisians really hated them. Eventually, the Parisians decided, we want the Burgundians back. But that's a whole other story that we'll get to next episode.
Juicy details for later.
Bring the butchers.
But basically, the Burgundian side wanted to paint Orléans with this, like, negative brushstroke. So they called them the Armagnacs. Because the Armagnacs became notorious as, like, these evil savages from the south who have come and are raiding everyone. Nonetheless, Barry Armagnac and Charles of Orléans, who, by the way, Charles of Orléans marries Armagnac's daughter, who is Barry's granddaughter. So they're all intertwined now.
Yes.
Even though they'd already been related, but now they're more related. So they formed a formidable opposition to the Burgundians. Of the three, though, Barry was definitely the least keen for war. He was the most passive. Yeah. And after 2 years of stalemate in the conflict in 1412, he backed out. Because Barry, his great castle at Bourges, his pretty castle, was being threatened by Burgundian troops. So Barry's like, I want to kind of do a bit of self-preservation. I'm going to, like, call it quits a little bit. So he kind of backed out, and that's when kind of the worst ravages of the Armagnacs started occurring when they occupied Paris. So yeah, Barry's kind of taken his hand off the scale. And he thenceforth kind of resumed the role of the mediating figure, which really frustrated his allies who wanted the Burgundians to just die. but unfortunately, Barry wouldn't live to see the conclusion of either the Civil War in France or the Hundred Years' War with England. Barry died in Paris on the 15th of June, 1416, during an outbreak of plague. Which is like that. He lived so long. He died at 75, and then to live that long and then die of plague is like, it's the worst.
So depressing.
So this occurred just after France's most devastating defeat at Agincourt, which you mentioned, and we'll get into plenty
of detail. How long are we into the Hundred Years' War? What year is it now of it, roughly?
So the Hundred Years' War started in 1329, and it's now 1415. So we're getting to endgame, now.
Finally.
You're so good at remembering those dates. I'm so impressed.
Joan of Arc's going to show up in about 12 years from where we are now. Yeah. But yeah, remember, the Hundred Years' War is slightly more than 100 years. It's like 111 years or something.
Yeah. So
bear that in mind.
111 years feels a lot longer.
But I think that's, I think it's mitigated by the fact that there were actually periods of peace. So it's actually more like 80 years.
Feels like 200.
If you take out the gaps of peace, but whatever. So actually, back to Agincourt, Barry had actually warned the other lords of France against charging into this battle, where many of them got captured. But he did successfully manage to ensure that his ward, the Dauphin, stayed away from the battlefield.
Mm.
So I'm not sure if you've seen the film The King with Timothy Chalamet.
I have.
Yeah, but basically Robert Pattinson plays the Dauphin.
Yeah. Yes.
And he's this like comically inept
yes.
guy with a terrible French accent.
Yeah.
And he gets slain by Henry V in the Battle of Agincourt.
Yes. Yeah.
This didn't happen because Barry
took
the Dauphin away from Agincourt. Also, the Dauphin was not as handsome as Robert Pattinson either.
He was
notoriously ugly.
Yes. Yeah, the Valois family had this unattractive streak.
We'll eventually see Charles VII's portrait, Eliza, because he does have a contemporary portrait. But he basically, I call him the Eggman because he just looks like an egg.
Yeah.
Maybe funny. That's where the song came from, the nursery rhyme.
Yeah, he looks like Humpty Dumpty.
Yeah, he does. He does. The Capetians were stunning, apparently.
They were like gorgeous, tall, blonde.
Elves. Yeah. Yeah, and then just something.
But then the Valois. Yeah.
What, like toads? Toads to the elves.
Yeah, although I would argue that Catherine de' Medici eventually brings some good genes in there.
Oh, good. Of course she would.
Her sons, for all their faults, her sons are gorgeous.
They're stunning.
Nice.
I do think that if you look at Charles of Valois' like tomb with his face on it, you can kind of see what happened. He's a very scary looking guy.
And that's the baseline you're starting with.
It's not great.
And add into that everyone marrying their cousins. It gets rough.
It's just not good.
So yeah, Barry's last useful act was to take the Dauphin away from Agincourt, prevent him from going. So the Dauphin manages to survive, and he actually manages to... the Dauphin is very lucky. He has quite a few lucky breaks at this point, but we'll get more into that in future
being
episodes.
Part of being the king is a bit of luck.
Yeah, like there's one point where he manages to like escape Paris in like the nick of time before the Burgundians take over. Yeah.
Oh, yeah, I love those nick of time moments.
But nonetheless, Barry leaves France at a dark moment.
Very dark.
Yeah. So Barry was the longest living son of King John II. He fell just 6 years short of outliving King Charles VI. And as I said, died at the age of 75. The only person we've reviewed who beats him for age is Eleanor of Aquitaine, who died at 82.
Oh, wow.
And again, women generally live longer.
She was riding on horses and stuff like that into her 80s, like doing stuff.
Absolutely.
Wasn't
she? She's like a queen, really.
She had like six, in like her like 50s or 60s, she had like 16 years of doing nothing. Yeah. So I feel like she just had all this like pent up energy because she was in prison for 16 years. Anyway,
age is just a number.
Despite Barry's longevity, he had been unable to produce a surviving legitimate son. So he and his wife Joan had had 7 kids, but the longest surviving son, also named John, had died at about 21 years old.
How did he die? The plague?
Of general inbredness.
Death.
Barry had just 2 surviving daughters out of those 7 children, which is kind of devastating. But they couldn't inherit Barry because it's a royal duchy, and royal duchies can only pass through dudes. But they could inherit other titles and lands that Barry had held. So the eldest daughter, Bonne, became the one who marries Armagnac. She became the Viscountess of Carla, and her younger sister, Mary, became the Duchess of Auvergne. So both ruled large parts of South Central France in their own nice. Right, and they expanded their influence through multiple marriages. And Bonne's second marriage was to her cousin, Count Bernard VII of Armagnac, who we'll talk about in a future episode, while Marie married the son of Louis of Bourbon. She married John of Bourbon.
Huh.
Yeah.
Yes. I like to say they kept it related They're in the next generation. They're very
intertwined. Oh, dear.
yep.
So that is the biography, the dual biography of
Can't wait till we'll meet some Bourbon. Different blood.
And now we're going to Enchanté. And Eliza, I'm going to send you the portraits of both these men.
Oh, I'm so excited to hear what your response is.
Enchanté.
Okay, so Eliza, this is the portrait of Veronica's man, Louis of Bourbon.
Oh, his hair. I love it.
Yes! yes, that is hair. That is not fur.
That is literally just my so hair you know. After I brush it.
He's very
one of my sons has hair like that. It's so cute.
That's beautiful. That was my hair when I was like in sixth grade when I had short hair and it was all frizzy when you'd brush it. That my hair was as I say, it's the triangle shape head.
That would have been so adorable.
No, it always makes me seeing that hairstyle makes me think of my like year six like school photos, because every time I had school photos throughout my entire school life, I always forgot. So then I'd have it always in the day I had the worst hair.
Oh no.
So Veronica, is this like a manuscript image?
I think it is.
I've got a manuscript image and I think it's more extravagant.
Oh, it is.
It's not a portrait, because we're still not quite really? Getting into the period where we've got like portraits of everyone that are like actual like formal portraits. So Eliza, I'm going to send you another manuscript image. This, it was produced under the Duke of Berry and it's got the Duke of Berry in it.
Oh, Partey. My God. Is he the one in, and yes. He looks like, oh my God.
So
like
he's the guy in the fur hat on the right, sitting down to a meal.
Of course. And he's got that elegant.
He's just bone. Look at his magnificent profile.
Oh, those bowl cuts. Yep.
I love this robe that Barry's wearing. It looks beautiful. almost like a sort of Chinese emperor kind of. This is from a manuscript that Barry that was produced it's a bit more complicated, but sort of under Barry's watch, called the Très Riche Heir. And we've actually seen another picture from this, Eliza. The picture of the Louvre that I've shown you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I thought so, because I was like, the top bit looks so familiar. I was like, is it?
That's a different page in this Book of Hours, which Veronica actually has an episode about the Books of Hours and what they are. So
nice.
I love Books of Hours, but yes, yeah. I do. It's literally called Books of Hours.
Yeah, they're gorgeous, and they give us little windows into like the lives of not just nobles, but also peasants.
Yes.
And this one is based around sort of activities that are occurring in different times of the year. So this is the one for January, and this is like a New Year's feast.
I like how there's a battle going on behind him.
Yeah, and there's just a casual...
One of those play battles they liked having around the holidays.
Is that meant to be a painting on the wall? Or is that... Cool. No, that's about...
It might be.
See, I thought it was like a wall.
It might
painting.
Be a tapestry.
Yeah.
It might be a tapestry.
Yeah, because it's gone onto the next
Probably
wall.
A tapestry.
Nice.
That's it, actually.
And yeah, everyone's got those like Henry V kind of hairstyles.
Oh my God, those hairstyles.
The bowl cuts. So Barry had this like huge library of like treasured books, including several Books of Hours. He's got not just the nice. Très Riche, but all, which is the very rich hours. But he's also got the Beautiful Hours, the Grand Hours, and the Turin Milan Hours.
Wow.
But this particular one is one of the most famous illuminated manuscripts of all time. Actually, probably the most famous. And it's different months stunning. Depict like various like events in like court life, daily life, nature.
Where can you see this?
There's a whole Wikipedia article about it, which has like all of the panels in it.
Yeah, but I mean real life.
Oh, good question, actually. It's now in the Musée Condé, which is a gorgeous museum. It's like a chateau.
That sounds amazing.
Which is...
I love a good chateau.
It's like just outside Paris, basically. So Barry has this like vast library, and this is kind of like a tradition among the Valois that we've seen so far. So the wife of Philip VI, the first Valois king, Joan the Lame, was a very keen collector of books, and her sons and grandsons built off this tradition.
Nice. Yeah, sounds like a good tradition. Actually, it sounds like my family's. Me and my mom have so many books.
So this particular manuscript and other manuscripts in Barry's library were created by the Dutch Limburg brothers, who are also sponsored by Philip of Burgundy. I think Josh mentioned them last episode.
Yes.
And this work is like a blend of like Flemish, French, and Italian painting styles. The Trebuchets was actually left unfinished when both Barry and several of the artists died in 1416. No. Probably all of the plague, I think.
My God, there's wee dogs on it. The table. Yes.
Yeah, there's so much. Eliza, you're gonna have to look at all of the pages after because they're all amazing. Yeah, but yeah, there was a later on in the 15th century, there was a later like Duke of Savoy who acquired the manuscript, and he picked up the production again like 70 years later.
Nice.
He had artists finish the manuscript. Yeah. So despite not entirely being produced in Barry's time, the manuscript is the most enduring part of his legacy. So I think it's fitting that I'm using the image of him from it. So yeah, the pages depict common activities. So like the January New Year's feast, February, they're collecting firewood and warming their feet. And it's like, by contrast, it's showing like peasant life. March, they're tilling the fields to sow seeds. April, there's like noble women collecting acorns. Like it's all, it's really interesting that all different walks of life participating in activities from like all different times of the year. It's such a gorgeous manuscript. I might return to it again.
Yeah. I just can't stop looking at the other person in the blue robe and the little gold thing.
Eliza not listening to anything I'm saying.
Don't worry, I was listening.
As usual.
Well, come on, you know what it looks like.
I'm excited to look through this later.
Expanding Barry's enchanté, because I think Barry's gonna clean up in this category.
Barry
had a huge collection that wasn't just books and wasn't just even from Europe. Like Barry owned the Fonthill vase, which is the earliest example of Chinese porcelain documented in Europe.
Oh wow.
Europe won't be able to produce its own porcelain until like the 18th century when they steal the recipe from China. Barry also owned a menagerie that basically amounted to a zoo. He's recorded as having ostriches and camels. But he was definitely mostly a dog person. He owned 1,500 dogs.
Wait, how many?
1,500.
Oh my goodness.
At a certain point. Yeah.
I'm good with my one. That's just too many dogs.
Yeah.
Sounds like a dream.
This is what happens when you hoard all the tax money.
Yeah.
That sounds great.
That honestly, all of this, everything Barry's doing is what I would do if I was a billionaire.
If you were taking taxes for the peasants.
If I was a billionaire and I didn't have a moral compass.
And you weren't a corrupt one taking the taxes.
Exactly. This is what I do.
You wouldn't send yourself to space?
No. I'd just cram myself in dogs.
So we've got literature, we've got animals, there's also music. Barry patronized the musician and poet Guillaume de Machaut, who is considered one of the most influential composers of the 14th century. And he has like an unprecedented level of like surviving musical notation. So you can actually play music from Barry's court today.
Thank you.
Barry is generally perceived as this, like, guy with, like, impeccable taste. He's, like, a fashionista. He's a trendsetter. Mm. And that's not including his architectural patronage. He ended up owning 17 castles.
Oh my god!
All of which he made into, he like transformed them all into like fashionable residences that were.
So that's what I judged just by castles. That, is that
like not just fortresses, but also like lavish balls and hunts, which is part of why like when Bourges ends up threatened by the Burgundians, Barry's like, oh no, I should have maybe built some. I maybe should have built some more like towers instead of like pleasure gardens. But
John the Fearless pulls out the heavy artillery, and everyone's like, oh, this is done. We're done. Okay. Yeah.
But it's honestly, it's remarkable how much was accomplished by Barry in such a turbulent period. Although,
because of his sticky fingers.
Although I would argue like he's contributing to the turbulence with his sticky fingers. So yeah, Barry's cultural output and legacy earned him the epithet John the Magnificent, which is also how he's known. So
such a deserving title.
When Barry died, he was in a lot of debt. He didn't leave a lot of money. He left a lot of lands to his daughters, but he didn't actually leave them a lot of money. They were both in a lot of debt. Bonne, who married the Count of Armagnac, ended up living very quietly in a castle way in the south of France. Like, she was out of public life because she didn't have the money. Yeah.
Oh.
But she's fine. She had 7 children, lived to the age of 70, so she was fine.
Oh, wow. That's pretty good.
Yeah. She was taken after her dad. But yeah, Barry ended up not getting a funeral. That's how poor his family was left after he died.
Oh,
And he was buried in Bourges, the capital of Barry, where his tomb effigy... So his tomb effigy is quite damaged, but 100 years later, a sketch of him based on the effigy was drawn by none other than Hans Holbein.
Oh! I love that picture.
The favorite painter of Henry VIII. And yeah, you can look at this picture up later, Eliza, but it shows him as like a smiling, rosy-cheeked...
It's a really old man. A really lovely picture.
He looks like one of those happy Buddhas, in my opinion.
Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, he's sort of praying instead of meditating.
Now, I'm going to cheat here for just a second, and I'm going to give both Barry and Bourbon equal points or equal attention for their support of one specific man who obviously in their lifetimes wasn't a great man, but would become the most brilliant poet of the period for France. So they were both quite supportive of Charles of Orléans.
Yes.
No, I'm going to give them both credit for that. Bourbon slightly more. Barry kind of fell apart at the end on that one, but I just had to mention that. They both might have known what a great man he'd become in the poetry area.
I mean, Charles of Orléans is quite impressive. He's basically, like, not only is he like a poet, but he's also like leading a civil war at the age of 13. So yeah. Props to him.
Yeah, I might take 3 hours when I come back again, just so you know.
But that's going to be Enchanté. So, Eliza, what's the verdict for Enchanté?
Go with Barry.
Yeah.
Just because it got the manuscripts.
Yes.
I agree with you 100%. Veronica and I both agree.
This was the one category that I was like, Barry definitely wins this one. Oh, the other ones I'm not so sure of, but we'll get into the other ones now.
We'll it has small dogs on the table. And he had so many dogs that, like, literally, yeah. That was an automatic win. So I heard about the dogs.
Doggies.
Okay, so we'll get into En Garde now. Oh, Veronica, last episode, Josh decided to take it upon himself to do the whispers for the categories.
Yes.
Oh, really?
Would you like to do that this episode?
No. No, thank you. I'll let Eliza do that.
Okay. We'll just use Josh's for this little mini series.
Oh, do that. Yes. Oh, I love that, actually. His French is quite good as well.
So Josh will be in all the episodes.
En Garde.
En Garde, yes. Would you like to start with
So I'm going to talk a bit about military agency. So he obviously in 1359 rescued Reims when Edward III was besieging it, which I think is a big win for France. In 1367 and 68, he took back Limoges, which is again, awesome. And then in 1378, he went to Castile to fight the Moors, which technically means he may have taken part in two crusades. But he had to return because Henry II of Castile tried to get the crusaders to help him attack Portugal. There was a big ongoing Castile-Portugal thing. So he, you know, made the right choice.
Portugal famously very Catholic. Not a great target.
No, it's really, really bad when the Pope says you can go fight and you go fight other Catholics. Don't do that. and then he, in 1378, and what is the biggest win is he took a bunch of Charles of Navarre, Charles the Bad's lands back. So I just think that's a win. That's nice. And then, yeah, the 1385, more fighting against England, 1390, the Barbary Crusade, which did fail, but he was 51, and it wasn't just him. And he didn't participate in the war. I will also say that when it comes to being a regent, trying to gain power over your nephew is a really bad thing. And so the fact that he never tried to gain power over his nephew should be counted in his favor, not against him, unlike a certain Burgundian. just saying.
Yeah, he was focused on sort of like setting Charles up rather than... setting him up to fail, which is what Burgundy was doing.
Yeah. I think he, like, favorite uncle, and he really just did the best to keep the king's agency intact and help Charles the VI be the best king he could be until the wheels came off.
Yeah. I imagine the scenario is like when Charles the VI has his bouts of illness, I think we could generously call it.
Yep.
Bourbon is right there, like by the bedside, whereas Burgundy is off, like assembling a council,
scheming,
and Barry's just having a party elsewhere. Yep.
He's like, "I'll deal with it later."
Yeah,
losers.
Barry's flirting with the maidservants.
Yes,
no idea what's going on. So Barry, not as much of a warrior prince. I could find like one battle that he participated in, and that was the Battle of Rusebeck, and that's really Philip of Burgundy's battle. So
he helped at Limoges.
He was definitely like present.
Yes,
but there's no record of like he was, you know, charging in the front lines kind of thing. I purely imagine him just being hanging around the camp, drinking. So Barry had a personal motto, actually, Le temps viendra, which means the time will come. And this kind of, to me, like emphasizes his like patience and level-headedness. Yeah. He was often seen as the voice of reason between squabbling members of the royal family, but he could also be overly cautious and often to fail to intervene or outright abandon court when things started getting dicey. So I think he's definitely comes off as a lot more passive than maybe any of the other uncles. Yeah. But he generally did oppose the overreaching of Philip of Burgundy and John the Fearless. He was never like fully committed. He always had like a little out where he's like, "Oh, but if they attack my lands, I'm going to withdraw and get the hell out of Dodge." And he was very disapproving of the Armagnacs and all the carnage that they were doing. So he was generally just very hesitant, I guess, as like an when it actually came to like decisive, like bold actions. But during the height of his power, Barry controlled about a third of France.
Wow.
This was mostly in the like south center of the country. He either controlled it as like his own territory or as like a governor, as like a lieutenant to the king. Even if he didn't necessarily use this power, he did have a huge sway over the direction of the war. Things were always going well for the Armagnacs when Barry was on was fully on their side, and things were going badly when Barry backed away. I noticed this trend. So like Barry, obviously, he was like this huge, and by the end he's like the last surviving uncle, so he's this huge like patriarchal figure in the royal family.
Yes.
And he's seen as having a lot of authority. Yeah. So I think even if he doesn't have like this long list of battles or anything, or if he it was maybe a bit more passive, he definitely has the ability to grant or withhold like all of this power. Like he's definitely had more of a me. Yeah, he's like a dragon sitting on a horde, and like he could breathe fire if he wanted to, but he doesn't.
He's like
this is me being very generous to Barry, but that's kind of intimidating in his own way. Anyway, so this will probably be a more difficult decision for Eliza, I think.
I think so.
Mm. Well, like, I know this category is like military, but it's also kind of more like personal gains.
Yeah.
And I feel as though Barry is definitely more about personal.
The selfish wins.
Yeah, than his counterpart.
Whereas Bourbon is quite selfless. And
yes. Yeah,
Bourbon's definitely, you can tell that, like, he's a good uncle.
Yeah.
But
he definitely wins that award.
Like, yeah, he definitely, like, he's probably the, like, the selfless one out of the uncles. Like, he's the least selfish, it seems like. Mm.
Although we'll get into it in Voulez-Vous when I talk about selfless wins for Barry, but he was a very good diplomat and very good as a sort of peacemaker. But,
yes, I'll give him
that. I mean, at least he made a very good effort, I should say. Whether or not he was successful, we'll get to that. But yeah.
Yeah.
On guard wise, he's definitely all about hoarding the power and the wealth.
So I think I'm gonna have to go with Barry again.
Yes.
Fair.
Like, I like Bourbon better as a person. I would want him as my uncle. He seems like a great uncle.
Yeah.
But in terms of being selfish, Barry's definitely more.
Oh, yeah.
This is very vindicating this episode, because last episode, Louis of Orleans got demolished in every category except for Ulala.
Oh, I can 100% imagine that.
Yeah. So let's move on to Voulez-Vous.
Yes.
All right.
Voulez-Vous.
I am going to say there are two big ones. So him agreeing to be a hostage so John II could return to France was super important, as well as his work on those negotiations for the Treaty of Brittany in general. I'm sure you guys know at this time, like, having the king in country is a really big thing. Yeah. And while John II is gone, things went really, really wrong for his son. So getting him back into the country was a huge deal. And at that point, Bourbon was 23 years old and not actually like John II's child or someone who was of necessarily that same value. And he volunteered to go. So I think that super
important. That really shows his character.
Barry, I feel like, was more kicking and screaming.
He was definitely forced on that ship. They, like, onto that ship.
On the upside, I think the English captivity is when Barry and Bourbon became besties.
Oh, yeah. I think it was the best thing for them. It just can't have been fun. And he was, like, I would say, if you were to do a family tree, he would have probably been 20th in line to the throne or something like that, because he was in line to the throne. He's quite useless in that sense, but because he was doing so much at the negotiations, he offered himself up. So I think like that type of thing is really ideal. And then deciding never to see John the Fearless again was an amazing political move.
I love that.
He's like, I'm done with you.
I like how he stuck to it. Like, that's a loyal guy.
Yeah, I don't want to ruin John the Fearless for you, so I'm not saying anymore. and then I think it's really important that he supported his nephew so much. And then when his nephew had his illness, he stepped in and again supported the throne and not his own personal benefit. So I'm big on good governance. Like, that's my thing. So I think he did a great job. This is where they're very different, I think.
Yeah, so Barry, I've already talked about his like cultural contributions. Yeah. I put that in Enchanté because a lot of it was about Barry aggrandizing himself rather than actually helping the people of France.
Yes.
Like, it does have like long-term good effects on French culture, like all of the patronage that he does, but this is now, and the people of France are not having a great time. So Barry's main political contribution, when he wasn't sitting on his butt trying to wait out the civil wars and the Hundred Years' War, was as a peacemaker and a diplomat, not just between the princes of France, but also internationally. He was a big diplomatic player. There was that point in the late 1390s when the Hundred Years' War looked like it might have ended. So Barry played a critical personal role in negotiating the truce with John of Gaunt in 1396, which included Gaunt's nephew Richard II's marriage to a French princess, Isabella. Although this came to nothing after Gaunt's death a few years later, and then in 1399, Richard II, who'd always been like pro-peace with France, was deposed by Henry of Lancaster, so Henry IV. And Isabella, the French princess, ended up stranded in England for years. So that's not a great outcome, but so, you know, Barry was trying. Oh, so we'll get to Isabella. Yeah. She actually ends up coming back and marrying Charles of Orléans.
Yep.
But so we'll get more into her, obviously. And there's a Rex Factor episode about her, so also listen to that. Nice. So Henry IV, the new King of England, he was much more politically cutthroat than Richard II.
Yeah.
So he used his troops to intervene in the French Civil Wars and like sort of play both sides off each other. And his son Henry V, as we know, will be even worse. And he'll try to conquer France altogether. And he's the one who wins the Battle of Agincourt. But this was all like in spite of Barry's efforts, which were all quite good. He wanted the royal children in his care to inherit a peaceful nation. But alas, very few of his peace endeavors were ultimately successful. And the Hundred Years' War would rage another 30 years after his death. So in the meantime, the notoriously brutal taxes levied by him and the other princes sort of helped to fuel the rage of the lower classes in France. Rage that either side of the Civil War often harnessed to escalate violence against the opposing party, which further destabilized the country and left it open to English invasion. So that's not amazing. I don't know why I put this in Billy Boo.
Really not that great.
Yeah, you're just trying to help me, that's all.
Okay, one last thing this is my Hail Mary, but Barry also became focused on trying to mend the ongoing papal schism between Avignon and Rome, which we haven't got into, and which we will not get into it in a lot of detail because it's very complicated. But basically, so Barry, he did his best to kind of mend the schism. He didn't get terribly far, but he contributed to the eventual repairing of the rift, which actually the schism ended just a year after his death in 1417. And after that, the Pope will remain in Rome and the Western schism is over. Again, a series of events that I'm sure Pontifax will cover eventually.
I will oddly cover these eventually.
I'm sure Veronica will talk about.
Because I plan on doing anti-Pope episodes. I'm so excited.
Yeah, I feel like the anti-Popes are a great subject for past. But yeah, anyway, so that is Voulez-vous for both of them. Eliza.
Okay. I'm going to have to go with Bourbon on this one.
Yes!
He's much just, easier choices.
I didn't need to think about that one. Like, he seemed like a good chap.
Yeah.
Good uncle.
I'm glad I put all of that cultural patronage in Argenté. I put my eggs in the right basket.
You chose well.
Yeah. Because he was not going to win.
Easy decision. But that was like the most easiest decision I think I've ever had to make for like any like category of any episode I've ever done so far.
Yeah.
That was the most easiest decision.
Being the good uncle. Being the good uncle. That's the key.
And then deciding never to make eye contact or be in the same room as the murderer of your nephew again is just the ultimate thing.
Which is in contrast to last episode when Eliza was undecided for Voulez-Vous.
Oh, yeah. Really?
She couldn't decide who was worse.
Oh, okay. They were both like equally. I was like, I wouldn't want to live with either of them.
I honestly wouldn't either. Like, I would have struggled through that episode so
Heart. So it's nice to have a nice easy one for once. Seriously, I feel like I would love to have him as uncle. Why couldn't have I had a really good uncle like that? Not saying that one of my uncles that I have now are not good, but
one that good. Yeah, aww, that good. Sorry.
Oh, they're nice, my uncles, but like, come on. I don't think I'd have, come on, how many people have an uncle who would make sure never to be in the same room as their
I don't think my uncles would be. Yeah.
I feel like my uncles would think poorly of if I got murdered.
They're very protective of me. Yeah.
I don't feel so one of my uncles. I really feel he would not care.
If your cousin murdered you.
Yeah, because that's what we're
talking about. Because he's already cut. We don't really talk to him in the family anyway, so.
But see, I think the difference is that John the Fearless is not Bourbon's nephew. He's the other uncle's nephew. But because Bourbon's on the other side of the family to Charles and Louis
second cousins, I think.
Second cousins. But by the standards of this time, that means they're not related.
Pretty much. they could get married if they were of the opposite.
Yeah, exactly.
It's only a little check mark from the Pope.
So, yeah, speaking of excellently segue to Ulala.
That was beautiful.
Yeah.
Ulala.
So, Bourbon. He was French, so he had a few, as in up to 9 illegitimate children from 2 or more mistresses. I know.
Damn!
They're just mentioned in various people's biographies and books, and I'm like, okay, I don't get names, I know nothing about you, I don't know who your mom is. But yeah, there were 9. It's not the record. I know you'll get to that at some point, so I'll leave that for you. Sadly, he's not scandalous with the royal finances. He really didn't have his hand in the cookie jar, and he didn't seem to overtax Bourbon lands. Like, he's got the illegitimate kids thing going on, but not the other bits of the scandal.
Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He was kind of a good guy in a lot of ways.
Barry, he was also a good guy, but he also loved a good time. And this included a love of women. Not only did he have that bastard that was sired during his English captivity, he also included references to his illicit lovers in his famous manuscripts, which is quite fun.
Oh my god!
Yeah. So in one book of ours, the Grande Heure, which let me remind you is a prayer book. The margins are decorated with bears and swans, and the French words for bear and swan are Ur and Cygne, and if you combine them phonetically, it makes the name Ur Cygne. It's supposed to have been the name of a woman that the Duke considered to be his true love.
Wow.
And this is like a mystery woman that we don't know anything about, so she was not noble, probably. And is conspicuously not called Joan, which is his wife's name.
Poor Joan.
Although he didn't necessarily neglect Joan because she gave birth 7 times. Did Joan?
I can't believe he put that in the margins of his book of hours. Like,
nice.
His prayer book, his like most holy thing he'd have other than his Bible. Like,
yeah. Wow. And this is like, this might sound like
just
like
to remember.
This might sound like a bit of a stretch, but think like in this time, like most people were illiterate. People were very good at interpreting visual cues and signs and that kind of thing. So this would have been obvious to people at the time, this little bit of symbolism.
Wow.
Because they just see, they see Ur Sin, like all over the page, and that's her name.
Sin it is.
Yes. I'm definitely not pronouncing the French word for swan correctly. It's like... it's not sin, it's like signe, but
sin now,
yeah.
You know, I'm Australian, give me a break. So Barry,
that's
gonna
be my excuse for everything now. I'm Australian, give me a break.
I'm gonna use that as my excuse too, even though Australian English isn't my first English.
You're a naturalized Australian.
Well, basically,
I am properly Australian. And my children are all Australian. They have funny little cute accents.
Yeah, it's like I get to be Scottish now. Yay. I live here, and I get to say that fantastic.
Well, I can't say that I get to be Japanese because that'd be racist as.
Nihongo ga wakarimasu ka?
That sounded really good.
I know that was really good. You got a little Japanese.
Okay, back to Ulala, back to Barry's scandal. He was condemned for his corruption. He did have that advisor who got burned at the stake, which is kind of like proxy punishment.
Wow.
So he's a bit scandalous in how like tyrannical and like high-handed that he could be. And obviously he's not the worst offender with the row of finances. Like he's not as bad as Burgundy, or Oléon for that matter, but he's still pretty bad. Arguably also he did invite the Armagnacs north. Well, he did like sort of help participate in that, because it's through him and like his daughter that Oléon ends up with the connection to Armagnac, like the marriage alliance basically. So he's kind of part of that. We'll get into it next episode, but that has like a really devastating effect on Paris. So overall, however, Barry did try his best to sort of place himself above the scandals of the Civil War. He always like kept even his allies at arm's length, as we've said. So he didn't want to get dragged into the mud. So like we had like a murder last episode. We'll get another murder next episode.
Yeah.
Oh, and the episode after that. Like, everyone else will be involved in murders. But both Barry and Bulba.
Oh, yeah, I missed.
Oh, my gosh, they're so...
I'm liking the regions of these murders. Sorry, I missed. We haven't had a good murder in forever.
This is why I decided to do this series, is because there's a murder in every episode.
It's but intense. Not this one. You knew I'd find it juicy.
Barry and Bulba are always far away from the scene of the crime.
They are.
Which is why I think putting them together is good, because... they actually stand a chance.
Yes. They have closer to equal chances.
But Liza, who do we think is the most scandalicious?
I think we all know the answer to that one.
To say it.
Yeah, you do have to say it. Sorry.
You have to say it for it to be true.
Okay. It's Barry.
It's Barry, yeah.
It's okay.
The juicy little fruit he is. The
I know.
Juicy little fruit.
That Book of Hours is impressive.
We actually forgot to record Josh saying Love Thee on Throne, so here's Eliza saying it instead.
Love Thee on Throne.
Now we get to Thee on Throne, and we get to an interesting situation where I'm pretty sure that Barry and Bourbon technically are regents for the same amount of time.
I think so, because I think we wouldn't count the time that Burgundy is John the Fearless is kind of controlling Charles and the Dauphin just a little bit. Like, I think that's... So it's the 16th of September, 1380 until the 1390s-ish. And then 1392 until whenever Philip the Bold and John the Fearless needed them. But really, at that point, the two of them just took over.
Yeah, so they're basically regents during the minority, like officially, and then like kind of unofficially during the quote unquote madness. Yeah, arguably, Love Thee on Throne is a tie. However, if I can just put in a little addendum,
you're already winning.
Barry outlives Bourbon by a few years, which arguably means that his influence extends longer. That might be a stretch. It's Eliza's call. That might be a stretch. I've already won the episode.
Prefer Bourbon to live longer, but
it doesn't really matter either way. Eliza, it's really your call.
They were almost the same age at death.
but we've never really taken age at death into account of Beyond Throne.
Oh, no, it's always like length I'm with
of reign. So, yeah, I think on reflection, I think, yeah, it should be a tie. I don't care anyway because I won.
It's a tie. It's a tie.
You did.
Yeah, it's a tie for that.
This was like a little thing I put in my notes in case I was losing.
I like you hedging your bets. I'm like, oh, I can find more stuff.
I'm getting strategic with this.
Oh, I don't blame you. You got lucky.
From last episode.
But hey, you get to, when you return, you get to have Charles of Orléans.
Oh my gosh. And there's so much more evidence for him.
Actually, you just get to know that in my heart, though, I prefer your guy.
Oh, yeah. Person. That's okay. I'm okay with losing to someone that is Barry. Like, that's okay. Yeah. He's pretty
and hey,
cool.
We're not guillotining these people.
Yeah, so that would be that. Very upsetting. Please don't do that.
They're not kings of France. They aren't up for. They aren't on the block.
Yeah.
You know, Bourbon gets a good. I think Louis of Orléans, who sadly lost last episode. I think they all get sort of very honorable mentions. They do. Made my list of. Yeah. Interesting regions. So.
They're all interesting to learn about, I find. Like, I knew quite a bit about Barry before coming in, but finding out that fascinating thing about his Book of Hours, and, like, I love little details like that.
Yeah. Mm. Louis of Anjou didn't make the list because he fucked off to Sicily.
Yeah. There's something with the Anjou clan.
Walking out of...
They just went and died, so I'm like, whatever. Actually, I had several people get mad because I didn't talk about Charles of Anjou, the great founder of the Neapolitan Anjous.
Really?
Well, my excuse is that he's the king of a different country.
No, I'm surprised
I don't really
people were
get into
upset.
Those kinds of weeds. People were like, "Why didn't you cover him?" I'm like, "He's not. Yeah, he's not.
He wasn't really involved.
You can cover him. God."
This would have been like a Patreon extra situation.
Yeah, that actually makes
which
sense.
We've covered. We've covered foreign rules and we covered Margaret, the Black of Flanders. Oh, that was like one of the options.
Fun.
We covered an Egyptian Sultan as well.
Oh wow!
Yeah.
On Patreon, yeah.
Those would be amazing.
Yeah, we covered the female Sultan who captured. Louis the Ninth. Veronica, I can send it to you. So yeah, that is John of Berry taking the cake for that one, and he will eventually be up against Philip of Burgundy in the final poll.
That is going to be interesting. I really look forward to those results.
Yes.
So Veronica,
yes.
Obviously everyone can reach you as Past Podcast.
Past Pod is on social media, it's at Past Pod. And you can even email me at pastpod@gmail.com. I discuss the almost kings and queens of history. So the individuals that never ruled because, you know, their brother locked them in a tower, or they died prior to the king, or they happened to be a woman.
So when will you choose the episode about me and how I should have been royalty in the world?
That may be a Patreon special episode at some point with me interviewing you, I think.
You'd hear about my world plans for domination.
I approve of these. I think there'll be dogs involved, so it's okay.
Oh, yeah, dogs and pods.
I think I made a mistake letting Eliza become the sole arbiter of this entire miniseries because the power's gone to my head.
Oh, it's okay.
See, this is what now you're seeing what anyway. I'd be like as a ruler. I would be corrupt as
dogs.
Anyway.
Oh, I mean dogs and chocolate. Oh,
actually, I realized we should let everyone know what a pod is because we don't have them in America.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so it's
they're
like
delicious goodness.
It's like a little
chocolatey deliciousness.
Cookie, a pod, basically. So a little cookie, teeny tiny, like a Reese's peanut butter cup, but instead of chocolate, it's cookie. And then
it's like caramel or...
Yeah, or peanuts and then chocolate over the top. They're really nice.
There's like Snickers flavor, like Mars flavor.
Mars is a Milky Way, my Americans, just so you know.
All right.
Thank you so much for joining us in part two of five of the Regency of Madness. And we can't wait to have you back in part five of five.
Thank you. I had a great time. I'm so excited. And I can't wait to talk to you guys again.
Yeah.
That's going to be au revoir from me.
Goodbye.
Goodbye from me.
here's the ultimate question, Veronica. Yeah. Do you like Vegemite?
I do not. I'm sorry.
How do you put it on, though?
Oh, properly. My husband's Australian. Like, I've got someone that can make it properly.
You don't do the thick slab.
No, no. And my kids all eat it. My children love it.
As long as you're not Nutella-y.
Yeah, no, if you're raised on it, you love it, I think.
Yeah, they eat peanut butter and jam and Vegemite and cheese. They're so cute. They're very...
Oh, Vegemite and cheese.
Together.
So American, no, like separately.
Peanut butter
Don't worry, separately. Two separate sandwiches. Yeah, don't worry. I don't do that.
I'm definitely a Vegemite and cheese advocate.
I can do Vegemite scrolls. So there's like less Vegemite and more cheese and more bread. I can do that.
The Baker's Delight ones. So
good. Oh, they're so good. They're so good. Now you make. I haven't had dinner yet. I'm hungry.
I need to have lunch.
You guys should
anyway,
come visit.
After that
come
tangent, which I'm probably gonna have to cut out
because that's okay. It's
sadly irrelevant. it gets even noticed with Eliza. I cut out. A lot regularly.
Even though I have to say, getting that comment that you sent me that someone said that they wanted to be friends with me.
Yeah.
Was like, made me think, oh, there's probably because of my tangents.
You definitely come off very, I make you look good with the edit, so.
I know.
I don't actually.
Otherwise, no one would want to be friends with me in real life.
Everyone, so you all know, Eliza's a terrible
Eliza's
person.
Crazy.
Eliza's awful.
I'm a monster.
You don't want to be friends with her in real life. Oh. I just make her look really good with the edit.
Oh, I found her lovely, so I would like to be friends with her in real life. So, Eliza, you have at least one person. That's okay. I will someday.
All right.
So yay.
Yay.
Literally, I think, though, that is the best compliment that I've ever got from anyone in my entire life is saying, I would want to be friends with Eliza in real life. I was like, that just really hits the spot.
It's so nice.
Okay, so it's my word against Veronica's and this random listeners.
yeah, that random listeners are mainly better.
Boom. Vote on Patreon whether or not Eliza's a terrible person. No, I'm just kidding. Yeah. So anyway,